Before we jump into the show, I wanted to take a minute to tell you about an exciting upcoming event. You may remember that I launched a live speaker series in March called Talking San Diego. You can get all the info for that at talkingsandiego.net. But with the success of our first event with Congressman Jamie Raskin, we are keeping it rolling. On May 15th at 7 p.m. at University of San Diego's Shiley Theater, I'll be in a conversation with MSNBC host and former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki about her new book, Say More, and other parts of her varied and exciting professional and personal life. I can't wait to bring Jen to the San Diego stage, and I really hope to see some Talking Feds fans there. To purchase tickets and for more information, plus an opportunity to get a signed copy of Jen's new book, click the link in the episode description. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent former federal officials and special guests for a dynamic discussion of the most important political and legal topics of the day. I'm Harry Littman. A legal and political spectacle, you might say, was 7 years in the making, opened its 4 to 6 week run on Monday, following Donald Trump's unsuccessful last-minute attempts to delay the proceedings. New York versus Trump, the first criminal trial in U.S. history of a former president, commenced in downtown Manhattan and by week's end had swiftly selected a full jury of 12 regular and 6 alternate jurors. There were notable stress points and challenges along the way, but Judge Juan Merchan was able to surmount them and complete jury selection in about half the time people had predicted. Trump himself was a figure of contrasts during the week, alternately attentive and sleepy, passive and angry. But he ended what must have been a very long week sitting down meekly at Merchan's command. It remains to be seen whether he can keep his cool as witnesses from his inner world tell the jury and, indirectly, the nation, the somewhat tawdry details of Trump's scheme to keep the Stormy Daniels affair from the voters. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson opted to support aid to Ukraine, Israel, and other U.S. allies, bucking the rump MAGA contingent that is vowing to bring him down. In the Senate, the articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas ended with less than a whimper. The week ended on an unanticipated note Friday evening with a Senate vote that reauthorized for 2 more years Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, a key national security provision that permits warrantless wiretaps. To zero in on what's happening behind the closed doors at the Manhattan Criminal Courthouse and in Washington, D.C., and their import for what remains a toss-up election, we welcome three of the most prominent political and legal journalists in the country. And they are Aaron Blake, a senior political reporter for The Washington Post, where he writes for The Fix. He's been a political reporter for over 20 years, having previously reported for his hometown, Minneapolis Star, Tribune, and The Hill. Thanks for being with us, Aaron.
Thank you, Harry.
Peter Baker, the chief White House correspondent for The New York Times, where he's covering his 5th presidential administration. Before joining The Times in 2008, Peter reported for The Washington Post for 20 years. He is also an MSNBC political analyst and the author or co-author of 7 books. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be with you.
And Jen Rubin, an opinion columnist for The Washington Post and an MSNBC contributor. Prior to her career in journalism, she worked as a labor law attorney for 2 decades. She's the author of the book, Resistance, How Women Saved Democracy from Donald Trump. Jen, always great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
All right. So pretty much just as we tape, the jury selection process in New York versus Trump has been completed. We have a full complement of jurors, 12 regulars and 6 alternates seated in the box, ready to hear opening arguments, presumably on Monday. on the charges against Donald Trump of covering up an affair with Stormy Daniels to illegally influence the 2016 election. Let's just start with this week in the jury selection process. What stood out to anyone about the process itself?
I think you had this strange contradiction. On one hand, it went really fast for a high-priced and high-level jury trial. I think it was not unreasonable to expect that this could have taken a few weeks, not a couple days. But in that sense, it was pleasantly ordinary. In other words, the legal system goes on. The court system does function at its own pace. And yet you had these moments where Trump being Trump intruded into the proceedings to make it bizarre, frankly, from outside, at least the presence of the judge, repeated a tweet that seemed to attack the jury as a whole. We saw the judge admonish him for grumbling and making some kind of facial gesture to a juror who had been dismissed. We're going to have a for cause hearing in a few days on whether to hold him in contempt. So it's almost like you have these two forces pushing up against each other. One, the normalcy and a certain majesty of the law. And the other is someone who is trying to undermine it, to try to create chaos and dysfunction. And it's a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah, you know, I felt the same way. It was remarkably quick. And I think that's because Mayor Chun, in a normal process, you would have all these people who express doubt about being fair and you'd subject them to sort of individual retail questioning. But he just said, go, we've got a huge panel and let's not waste time. And then otherwise it was one foot in front of the other, except punctuated by, if you sort of drew it, you would have these spikes of chaos and crisis from jurors, from tweets of Trump, from people outside the courthouse, most recently a man who set himself on fire. One way to look at it is just these two things going on in tandem. Another way to look at it is that the eruptions of chaos and irregularity and abnormalcy come potentially to dominate and threaten the overall majesty or just simply, you know, public confidence in what's going on. Does it come to seem, just because of the vividness of these chaotic episodes, a kind of a shit show that all in all leaves big swaths of America kind of, you know, dismissive or lacking in confidence about the whole thing?
I think that's a good point. This is the case that the American people are the least concerned about relative to the other three indictments that Trump is facing. It's the one they're taking less seriously. It's the one that seems to be a deal breaker for the fewest Americans. Again, relative to the other cases, that doesn't mean it wouldn't matter if he is convicted in this case. It just means it probably matters less. And it seems to me that Trump is in certain ways kind of seizing on that fact to try and throw this process into disarray from the very beginning with the comments that were directed towards the juror, according to the judge, with the posts about the jurors, you know, quoting Jesse Waters, questioning the neutrality and the fairness of the jurors, testing the gag orders. It almost seems like the fact that the gravity of the trial here isn't as great is something that plays into Trump's advantage a little bit. You know, I'm not saying he wouldn't be doing this if it were one of the other three trials, because if anything, we've seen that he does this in every trial to some extent. But the fact that it is kind of the lower stakes trial, I think, enables him to be a little bit more comfortable doing this and maybe gives his lawyers less, not necessarily less pause about him doing these things, but maybe they're a little bit less concerned about it.
I'm struck by the fact that because it's not televised, you don't really feel it in the same way you might have in a proceeding that Americans could actually watch, right? They're relying on us reporters to tell them what's happening. And while I think we're faithful narrators, we're not nearly as dramatic as actually seeing their original proceedings themselves. And I'm really struck because this comes at times a couple weeks after the death of O.J. Simpson. And I'm reminded of how his trial, the original criminal trial, so captivated the nation, in part because we could watch it, because we saw it play out in a very, you know, court TV, Perry Mason kind of way, almost in front of our own eyes. That was called the trial of the century. Well, if this isn't the trial of the century, the trial of a president of the United States for the first time in nearly 2.5 centuries, then what would be? But in fact, I don't think it has quite absorb the general public in the same way as the OJ trial. And in part, it's because they're not directly involved through TV. And in part, by the way, is because Donald Trump actually is no stranger to a courtroom these days. And he has been in court so much, so many times up until this week, before this week, on civil lawsuits and on motions hearings and so forth, that I think that even just the very image of him in a courtroom no longer has the power to shock. It no longer suddenly seems like, holy moly, we've got a president in the dock here, because in fact, they're used to him being in the dock. And many Americans might not really focus on the fact that this is a criminal trial, not a civil trial. They're aware of it, obviously, but they're so used to him being a defendant and under the scrutiny of lawyers and judges that it may not have grabbed them in the same way that it would have under other circumstances.
I would just say that we're only at the stage of selecting a jury. We haven't even had the argument at the beginning of the trial. So it's hard to kind of evaluate the degree of attention that this is going to grab and also the degree of importance, as Aaron said, that is applied to this. If, for example, Trump takes the stand, which most lawyers think would be insane, but is exactly what the sort of thing that Trump might want to do, I think that would be an absorbing fact. And I think something happens during a trial, even if going in, the jurors, the commentators don't seem to say that this is the most important one. These things do take on a life of their own. And whatever the verdict is, that's going to be huge. If it's a hung jury or he's exonerated, that's going to be monumental for him. And if he's convicted and is facing some kind of sentence, that's going to be monumental. So I think at this early stage in the game, it's sort of like, you know, watching the trailers before the movie. We got to see how it comes out. But I think that sense of shock may still be with us, particularly when the jury announces its verdict, is going to be huge.
Well, and I can make the argument that this trial is certainly of a piece with the other trials, right? That there is a through line in these four cases, and that this is obviously the one that seems less important, as Aaron rightly said, because it's about sex and hush money, and that seems like a scandal, but is it really a constitutional crime? Well, I mean, at essence, though, is the idea of cheating to win an election. That's the allegation here. And that's of a piece with what happens not only on January 6th, but in the entire weeks leading up to January 6th, the weeks after January 6th, and every year, every moment since January 6th has been about, in his case, trying to, you know, if you go along with the prosecution anyway, illegally defraud the country of its right to a fair election. And so while it seems small, I totally get you and I agree, Jen, that it actually is kind of important. It's just that we have so much with Trump that it's hard to like maintain a fresh sense of outrage. And maybe the testimony will make that. I definitely think you're right that the verdict one way or the other will be huge, even though this is the least, quote, important trial.
Well, so and very important agrees with Peter, and that is the judge. That's essentially the little opening spiel he read to the jurors. So at least in the eyes of the judge, that's the frame for the case. It's going to be really interesting to see whether Alvin Bragg makes it more about that or more about the details of the documents and the witnesses and the cover-up.
Yeah, and to the point that both you guys are making, you know, I mentioned the number of Americans who view this as being very serious or think that Trump is guilty in this case. If you actually look back at the polls in 2018, when this issue first came about, you know, there was the Wall Street Journal story about these payments to Stormy Daniels, and then it kind of mushroomed from there. If you look not just at the people who like think Trump is guilty, but think he did something unethical in this case, it was actually in a lot of cases greater than what it was with the Russia investigation, which was also very current at that time. And so it may be a situation where the American people don't believe this is the worst thing that Donald Trump might have done, but it's also something that bothers them. This was 8 in 10 people who thought that Trump had done something at least wrong in this situation. Maybe not illegal, but at least wrong. And so to the extent that they are being reminded of this episode from the past that at least in real time they thought was a bad thing and kind of reflected poorly upon Trump, I do think that is significant. And I don't mean to say that the trial is not significant, it's just less significant. But rekindling this whole thing kind of brings us back to a moment in which this was a pretty big deal.
These are all really excellent points. I just have a couple follow-ups. I've avoided using his name in any tweet or Twitter, but to Peter's point, I have several times over this last week had in my mind the name Judge Ito? And will, in fact, Juan Merchan, you know, can he keep control or what will it take? You remember the OJ trial itself. Boring, 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 and but then crazy shit. Boring, 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 crazy. But that's how we remember it. He seems hard-nosed, quick to gain control, but he's facing such a formidable sower of chaos in Donald Trump, whose purposes are served by doing it. And then second, and you tweeted this out, Aaron, as well. Yes, it's not televised. And yes, when you read it about it all, it's the thing that makes people sit up and take notice, maybe the least. But there's something really vivid about a trial process that I think people don't register till it actually happens. The people call Hope Hicks, and here she walks in front of him, and this former Trump acolyte who is totally credible says these damning things. I just think it sort of in the manner of, say, the January 6th committee, even if it's things we largely know, it hits home strong. Let me zero in a little bit more on the defendant. You're also right, of course, Peter, that we've seen him many times in court now, but not having to, like, have his ass in the chair and not move and have Merchan chastise him if he is even a little bit out of line, and 4 long days a week. You know, he was by turns, it seems to me, passive and engaged, attentive and sleepy. I actually asleep, it seems, tuned out and hopping mad. You know, what's your take? It does seem, for whatever reason, that he's especially upset about the nature of the charges, not simply the election interference, but the whole thing with Stormy, which he's continued to deny from the start. What Trump do you think are we likely to see as the trial progresses?
I think we're going to see, reality show Trump. I think we're going to see the performer. We're going to see the showman, the funny faces and the scowls and the, you know, performative grumbling and all that. It's all part of the show. And it's how he has succeeded at politics. He's the first president we ever had, never spent a day in public office or the military, right? What he had spent is 14 years on television, trying to get people to come back and watch the exact same show over and over and over again for 14 years. There was no new show. It was the same show over and over again. So we had to find ways to keep the audience entertained and wanting to come back.
One of the jurors said they listened to it in junior high and liked it.
Oh, I confess it's not been a show I spent a lot of time with. But I mean, imagine, right. I mean, the whole plot of the show is the same every week, right? So he has to do something to get people to pay attention. That's his nature. That's his superpower, you might argue, in politics. So I think that's what he's going to do these next few weeks.
I'm of two minds on that, Peter. On one hand, I think he is trying deliberately to bait the judge. Because he, every time the judge comes down on him, whether it's a gag order, whether it's whatever, he gets to play the victim. He's cold. He complains about that. Everything is this victimology because that's an important emotional tie with his base. On the other hand, there is a point at which I think he can't control himself. And I don't think it's all deliberate. I think he has been told innumerable times by his counsel that he's got to behave. And I think one of the things we're seeing, Harry, that he is so annoyed by, this might be the first time in his life he does have to sit there and take it and listen to people who are not enamored of him. And he heard all those jurors say bad things about him. Many of them were dismissed.
Not all of them. Number 11.
But not all of them. And so I think part of this is setting up the victim role. Part of this is his shtick, as Peter says. And part of it is he's never had any impulse control. And even if it hurts him when he gets in front of the jury, because the jury's not going to like that, I don't think he's necessarily going to be able to rein that in. That is who he is.
Yeah, I agree. I don't mean that it's deliberate necessarily. I just think it's instinctive. It's his nature. It's who he is and what he does. And you're right. I think if a lawyer told him it's incredibly damaging to do this, he would still do it.
I'm reminded of after the E. Jean Carroll civil defamation trial concluded, Roberta Kaplan, the lawyer for E. Jean Carroll, gave an interview to Politico magazine, I believe it was. And she reflected on these kind of courtroom antics by Trump and the impact that they might have had on the case. And her contention, and you know, obviously she's not a disinterested party here, but her contention was that when Trump did this big outburst in the middle of that trial, she thought to herself, oh, good, the award just went up by $10 million. And of course, it wound up being more than $80 million. Similar in the New York fraud, civil fraud case that Trump had an outburst like this in. That didn't go well for him. Both of those were huge judgments against him. The E. Jean Carroll case especially reflected kind of a continued Trump commentary that didn't seem to serve his purposes and got him into legal trouble. So yes, there is a part of him that kind of maybe can't help himself. And I think it's always tempting to look at what Trump does and like try to look for the strategy behind it. And sometimes it's just literally who he is and that he can't help himself. And that people in his position, people with a lot of money, people with this kind of degree of fame, they don't often have a lot of people around them that are able to tell them that what they're doing is unwise. And I think that it's going to be a really interesting thing to see how this kind of conduct plays with the jury. You know, it's very clear that Trump is going to push the envelope on things like talking about jurors, talking about the judge's daughter, violating the gag order potentially.
Grumbling and grimacing in court. He almost can't help the glower and stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yes.
Let me follow up and broaden it, of course, because, you know, he's got a dual strategy because he has one eye on the election. So, Jen, in keeping with what you just said, you had tweeted that in his mindset, baiting the judge, even risking conviction, might seem politically advantageous because his supporters rally to his side. But what about this all-important, we think, slice of undecided voters? To the extent it's a political calculation, is it a poor one?
Whether it's poor or not, this is Trump's politics. He's never cared about anyone outside his base. It has been about inflaming and engaging that part of the base that really doesn't care what the mainstream media says, that doesn't care necessarily what objective facts, that simply follow him. And listen, if he were concerned about the middle, he wouldn't do things like keep popping off about how proud he is that he reversed Roe v. Wade or that the justices he appointed repealed Roe v. Wade. So his political advisors may kind of cringe. And in the abortion context, of course, they tried to kind of have it both ways for exactly that reason. But when he gets in front of his fans, he doesn't play to the middle. He talks about poisoning our blood and being a dictator on the first day. That stuff is in his veins. And talking about a lack of self-control, we've seen him so far since the trial has started without his audience. Can you imagine him restraining himself when he's out in front of one of those big crowds? I think even if it winds up that he's detained in the little holding cell behind the judge, he's going to do it because that's who he is.
Well, let me follow up with just that point, right? I mean, the DA has said that he had seven more violations of the gag order just today, three before. They're going to have a hearing on it. New York law doesn't seem to give Merchan that many options before going to some brief period of incarceration. How likely are we to see a kind of conflict that is really, you know, Merchan is forced to the point of saying, next time, Mr. Trump, you know, there's a holding cell in back. And then if he says next time, really, it is in Trump's hands, right? If he says next time, he's got to follow through.
Yeah, it's a huge question in this. And I think it's maybe a telling moment early on here has been when the judge put the gag order into place earlier this month. One of the things that he held out there was not just fines or a weekend in jail or whatever, but he threatened to withhold the names of jurors from Trump's defense team, which was really interesting at the time and kind of suggested that like he was trying something different versus, you know, the other judges who have handled this and the fines haven't been enough to dissuade Trump from doing these things. But then Trump at the very least flouted the gag order that the judge had put in place. And then his legal team got the names of the jurors. We haven't seen that issue, those initial complaints about the violations of the gag order by talking about the judge's daughter. We haven't seen that considered. And so I think that kind of reinforces that, like, there are going to be a number of steps in this process. It's not going to be one strike and you're out. He's not going to go down that road unless he feels like he has no option whatsoever besides that. And even then, it's not an easy call. The fact that this is a 6-week trial, that's a lot of days for stuff to happen. That's a lot of days for Trump to be having a bad day and decide to act out more than usual. And something like this could certainly come to a head.
It's 100% true. And I just want to say relative, I think he keeps a pretty good control and keeps his cool. Judge Merchan, when he expanded the gag order, he didn't get passionate about the attacks on his daughter, whatever. But I think New York law gives him fewer tools. The fines that they're asking for are the statutory maximum of $1,000, which is to say, you know, nothing. So I just think jail in some fashion probably has to come into play sooner rather than later, the way New York law works. Though, as you say, nobody wants it except possibly, and this is what we'll see, Donald Trump.
That's what he said during the, I don't remember, it was the Carroll trial or the New York civil fraud trial. It was, yeah, the judge was basically like, I think you want me to throw you in jail. And Trump said, I would love that. Whether he actually wants that personally, maybe he wants it politically, but not personally. But yes, I think it's a very valid question.
To Aaron's point, it sort of came up again because the defense usually is granted the courtesy of knowing the order of witnesses. They have a whole list of witnesses, but they don't know the order. And the DA said, no, we're not going to give it to you because you're going to go out and attack these people. And what was so bizarre about this is that the judge said, yeah, you're right, which was an incredible sort of acknowledgement. And when the lawyer got up and said, well, I can promise you it won't be out on Truth Social, the judge sort of, again, you missed the body language and the expression, but he said, you can't promise that. So there is this governing assumption already that he is uncontrollable. And he has lost something because of that. His lawyers don't have the little advantage, however much you give that, to prepare the day before, 2 days before, for those particular witnesses. So these little strategic dings that he gets are not without penalty. It's not the biggest deal in the world. It's not like they haven't researched Michael Cohen, but it does hurt him to some extent.
Quick interjection, this is not a little thing. Speaking as a trial lawyer, it's that weekend. Yeah, you're generally familiar, but the actual bearing down on what the cross-examination is going to be question by question, to have to do this for everyone possible. Like, you could imagine Michael Cohen being first. They've talked about him as the kind of general tour guide, as if you will. But I don't see his being first for tactical reasons, but they got to prepare for him now and prepare for everyone. That is the definition of, for the lawyers, of a hellish weekend. Let me just take a minute to ask you if you had any impressions about the jury itself that was seated. You know, it's a very Manhattan jury. Jen, I don't know if you've ever had jury duty. I have, but I've never been chosen. Two lawyers are on this, a lot of kind of white-collar Manhattan types. But we know that Trump was looking hard for a holdout maverick type, and we know that the DA would have been looking hard for collegial, professional, better educated people. We're not in the courtroom. We just have thumbnail sketches. But anybody have any sense of the jury overall?
Struck by a couple of things. I'm struck by the fact that there are three lawyers on there, right? Because I you guys are the lawyers and I'm not. But I would imagine that you might feel some queasiness about putting a lawyer on a jury unless you felt really strongly you knew their history a little bit better. I'm struck, too, by how much this jury knows Donald Trump. And of course, any jury anywhere in the country would know Donald Trump. He is universally known. He is obviously a former president. This would be true anywhere. But I'm reminded of like how much of a presence Trump has been in the New York ecosphere for the whole lives of most of these jurors, right? And Aaron and Jen's paper did a fun Q&A with people on the street last week, I think, of people in New York asking, would you serve? And if you serve, could you be unbiased? And what do you think of Trump and all that? And the answers, I was really struck by how many of them felt that they knew him or had a sense of him, not just from the White House, but from his days as a New York figure, celebrity, you know, persona. They may never have met him, but they had a sense of him and they had a sense of who he was. And while we obviously think of New York as a liberal blue city, there were a lot of people in that sample, and again, it's a small sample, who were not at all, you know, hostile to him. Just because it's a Democratic city does not mean that the jury is automatically against him. And I was on a jury last year. I've only been on a jury once in my life. It was last year. It was a tiny case, a gun charge case. By the way, it took 3 days to see that jury, which is kind of, I admire Judge Mershon's ability to get this one done in only four, given how consequential it is. But I was struck by my jury hung. We could not come to a resolution. And my takeaway from that experience is it's hard. I can't imagine how you can get 12 people in America today in the polarized country that we live in to agree on anything, right? And in DC, this wasn't a particularly ideologically divided jury, but everybody just had a different opinion. And it was just really striking to me on a very simple case, by the way, very striking to me how hard it was to get unanimity on even those basic things. So the idea that we're going to get unanimity is really an interesting challenge here. Now that we have had that happen, obviously, you know, he has had some of these cases. There was a criminal case, we forget this, of the Trump Organization, his business, which was convicted, by the way. There is no distinction between Trump and his business. So you could argue that Trump has already been convicted in a criminal setting. Plus these civil cases, he has faced juries and they have come to unanimous verdicts. But I'm just struck at how challenging it could be for these 12 people to agree on this.
I'm remembering right now when the grand jury returned the indictments in the Georgia election subversion case, the one where Trump is indicted alongside a lot of his associates and high profile people. And they actually released the grand jury vote totals from each of those defendants and each of those counts, or potential defendants, I guess, in some cases, and each of those counts. And if you looked at them, it was like there was at least one vote against all of these. So it seemed like there was one person who was just like, nope, not gonna go for any of this. Didn't matter what the evidence against any of them were. And so that's a reminder, like the unanimity looms large here. You know, Manhattan is obviously a very blue place, but all it takes is one. And that seems to be kind of what Trump and his allies are at least banking on.
I think so, because I think they have no chance of an acquittal. Plus, there's a tricky legal issue that a sophisticated jury may well take seriously here. And also, it's just at the end of every process, you're out of peremptory challenges. There are a couple people on that jury for each side that they are really not sure about. They will always be looking at the breaks. It's going to be, did you see the number three seem to be nodding when so-and-so said this? They're going to be biting their nails over it going forward. And of course, in precisely different and complementary ways, because Trump wants that one and they want it all.
You know, it's funny. Two lawyers made the mistake, I think, of putting me on a jury. It was a murder trial. And because it was a very complicated charge under a sort of murder charge that is no longer available in California, this was in Superior Court, a lot of people couldn't get their minds around the sentence that someone who didn't do the shooting could be held responsible for murder. And the DA did her best. She put out chairs with A, B, and C, and she tried to do it. But because of that, we wound up with a really unusual jury. I was on it. There was a editor from Sports Illustrated. There was a museum curator. Our jury foreman was the superintendent of a school district. And so you wound up with this super demographically, economically, educationally, you know, tilted jury. And it was interesting. I think to some extent, that makes consensus a little bit easier. These are all people who are kind of operate in the same world, if you will. There's a certain level of respect. There's a certain understanding about how the world operates. All these people, by and large, were the sort of people who don't have problems with the police, frankly. And so who gets on the jury and the dynamics is utterly fascinating. And, you know, we may never know kind of how it works. And in this case, because of the weird way New York law works, neither one of the lawyers, I believe, is going to be the foreperson. And that matters a lot. The foreperson does have a lot of sway. And in New York, it's just the first person in there. In every other jurisdiction I'm familiar with, you actually vote on the foreperson. That's like the first big decision, and is a problem if you can't do that. So it's going to be fascinating. These things are like a little slice of America. And can they all agree on something? Do they see the world the same? It really is pretty fascinating.
And we will never see it. I just want to make a quick point, whereas there have been some people saying, oh, a lawyer, that's good for both sides. there's no such thing as a lawyer good for both sides, as a juror. It's a zero-sum game, and you want a certain kind of juror if you're him, your best chance of a holdout. And when I was thinking about him, there was one juror who said, I was on a jury once, but I don't remember how it wound up. And that, I think Donald Trump would like a juror like that, as opposed to people, as you say, Jen, they're used to working groups and collegiality and responding and all that kind of thing. All right. Opening arguments and the DA's chance to make the case, as you were talking about, that this is an election interference case, which Bragg seems to want to do. What should we be looking for in the first week of evidence in the trial? And I'll start. There's two things that I think are going to be pretty interesting. One, there are just going to be a couple witnesses. I think Michael Cohen could be, and I think they're counting on him to be, a wash. I think it'll be a very long cross-examination where Mayor Chun finally says, you know, enough is enough. We know he's got a perjury conviction. But I think a witness like Hope Hicks, you know, a few who are really sort of come off as neutral will be strong. And then there's going to be little skirmishes. The judge has permitted the DA to tell a story that begins with a broader catch and kill scheme and David Pecker from the National Enquirer and Kathy McDougall, a woman who previously came forward. But that has the potential of just making Trump look bad without advancing the charges in this case so much. And you may see some, you know, grandstanding and bitterness from Trump, you know, and real sort of in-court headbutting as that part of the story is laid out, which I expect will be early. If I had to guess, that's, I think, where they'll actually begin.
One thing that lawyers try to do is they try to preempt the other side from making hay out of the worst part of their own case. So I would expect you're going to see the DA kind of prepare the jury for Michael Cohen. And they're going to say things like, we have a witness, he's been convicted, but I didn't choose this witness. This is the kind of person Donald Trump hung around with. So you can't expect a Boy Scout to come in here if it was someone who is doing the dirty work for Donald Trump. Conversely, I think the defense is going to be very smart to say, a lot of people don't like Donald Trump. He can be a jerk. He is not everybody's cup of tea. They may even admit in the facts of this case, although their client probably won't let them, that he behaved like a scoundrel. But that's not your charge. Your charge is to apply the law and the facts beyond a reasonable doubt. And that way, they're not in the position of defending Donald Trump, the person, let alone Donald Trump, the politician. And they force the jury to kind of put that aside, too. So I'm going to be looking for that dynamic. How much defensive work do they do in the opening, which is not usually where you see the defensive work in a trial.
I think it's a great, great point. And of course, they've got their client in the chair hearing all the, you know, about what a jerk he is. And man, that's going to be, it's going to be a lot of focus on him. And can he keep a poker face? I tend to doubt it.
Do we take bets on whether his defense team remains the same throughout the entire 6 weeks?
Right, right. Familiar way to try to pull a delay out of thin air. Oh, I've had to fire, my new counsel has to get up to speed. He does have two credible lawyers if he'll let them do their bidding. If I were laying odds on different things, I think a very interesting bet would be how many alternates will wind up being seated because some crisis will have dislodged others. Will we get to number four? Will we get to number five? So we're even starting to get nervous. I'll say one other thing, which is, as this week showed, I think it's going to be shorter than people are expecting. A well put on case really should only take 2-3 weeks. The witness list for Trump is two people. One of them is Trump. That is one person who, Jen, will talk about this more, but I see as a pretty surefire bet not to testify.
Can I ask the lawyers, you and Jen, about that? I mean, like, I've read that and heard that if he were to testify, they could bring in his testimony from other, some of these cases that we've just seen in civil court and everything. How does that work? What would the point of that be, and why would that be relevant?
Right now, as we tape, there's a hearing going on where they're deciding, because you have to give notice. It's relevant because he's put his credibility on the line. So you could really take any of the Washington Post. How many did you guys document?
30,000
lies. Or just take your top 20. Anything that goes to his credibility, which he has now put in issue.
And that's why you may see, if he does testify, and that's going to be an arm wrestling exercise with the lawyers, because the lawyers in no way want him on the stand. But as Harry says, right now they're doing what's called the Sandoval hearing, which the DA listed like a zillion of these possible things that they want to cross-examine him. The judge is not going to let them all in because the prejudicial value will outweigh the probative value. But some of that's going to get in. And that's a big disincentive for Trump to get up there. I would also say that if you get up on the stand and you perjure yourself, it doesn't go well in sentencing if you are convicted. It is not a no harm, no foul kind of proposition. You usually don't get penalized for perjury because you're allowed to defend yourself. But in sentencing, oh yeah, that can be a big factor for the judge.
And I don't think the DA would hesitate to bring a separate perjury charge as well. He's so undisciplined. What a mess it would be. All right. Arguably my favorite moment in a podcast, when we leave Donald Trump and shoot down the coast to Washington and spend a few minutes there. Pretty tumultuous and dramatic week, very much overshadowed by the events in New York. But the Speaker of the House, A, is fighting for his survival, and B, he's now coming out in support of Ukraine aid, notwithstanding fierce opposition from hardliners in his party and the looming threat of his own ouster. Why did he, you know, adopt this stance, and is he going to survive?
If you look at the way Speaker Mike Johnson has talked about this issue from the very early days of this war, there's been kind of this idea that he's been this anti-Ukraine funding guy from the very beginning. In the early days, he talked about this in much the same way the hawks in his party did. Like, you know, we can't let Putin march across Europe. Like, this is super important. Even after he was elected speaker, he gave an interview to Sean Hannity in, I think it was late October, where he discussed Ukraine aid being a priority for him. He mentioned it alongside helping Taiwan and combating the influence of China. He mentioned it alongside Iran. He did vote against Ukraine aid when he was a backbencher in the House, but it was always kind of couched as, we need more accountability for this money. And so I didn't think it was necessarily a question of whether he would go there and actually go to bat for Ukraine aid eventually. It was always about arranging the politics in a way that this could be somewhat acceptable for his conference and not necessarily cost him his job. And then, of course, he's talking about recently about how he's getting these intel briefings that kind of drive home the importance of this issue for him. And so I think it just took a long time to get to this point where he felt strongly enough about the issue and he felt like he had a way to get this done. But maybe it's not that surprising of an outcome that we ultimately got here after a very long time.
Peter, you wrote that we provide less aid to Ukraine than the EU does. And I don't know how he tries to manage his right flank, but it does seem like he's just being responsible. Is that possible? And does he survive it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, look, there is a difference between being a backbencher and being the speaker, right? There is something about taking office, taking a high office, and the responsibility and the weight and the burden that comes with that. It's not a free vote. When you're a backbencher, you can vote. You can pretty much vote any way you want without a huge amount of consequence, or at least you don't feel the consequence that you do when you are a president or a speaker or a Senate majority leader or what have you, right? This is actually the theory of the case with Donald Trump that proved the exception that proves the rule. A lot of people thought when he took office that weight of the office would somehow sober him and mature him and he would somehow be less of who he was. But in fact, he obviously did not. So that's not a rule that applies across the board. But, you know, if you go back in the history of speakers, John Boehner was a rebel before he became speaker. Paul Ryan was a rebel before he became speaker. When they become speaker, suddenly they're the responsible party. And I think it weighs on them more heavily. And they do get these intelligence briefings, which the backbenchers don't get. And you begin to think, I am responsible for something larger than my own personal survival in my congressional district, which is otherwise what he would have been responsible for. And I do think that sometimes that has an impact. Now, I also think there are politics here. Of course, last weekend, when Iran struck Israel, the Republicans were eager to make the case that this is all Biden's fault, that he is weak. This shows how weak he is. It's really hard to make the argument that he is weak on the foreign policy stage if you're the one not providing or blocking the aid for Israel and Ukraine in the first place. You cannot make the argument that he's the weak one for not supporting our allies when you're not supporting our allies. So there is a political reason to finally get off the ball and move these along. The solution he's come up with is exactly the solution that would have been obvious, and Aaron probably knows this better than I do, but I think this is the obvious solution months ago. Break it up. Let everybody vote on the part that they like. The Democrats aren't going to like, a lot of them on the left don't like the Israel thing, so they'll vote against that. But they can vote for the Ukraine thing. Republicans who don't like the Ukraine thing can vote against that, but they'll vote for the Israel thing. There'll be majorities, obviously, for each of them. And then they do the sidecar legislation, which allows them to perform as they want to perform. So I don't know. It's probably a mix of politics and the burdens of the office, and we'll see. I don't think he's done anything to protect himself in terms of his survival as speaker in the last few months that has changed the dynamics. I think those dynamics are the same today as they would have been a couple months ago. So that passage of time hasn't really changed that part of the equation for him. I guess he finally just got to the point where he realized he wasn't going to get any better.
I think there are a couple of things that also changed. One is they did have this motion, a discharge petition. And there's nothing more embarrassing than having the other side unjam something and then have a big bipartisan vote. I mean, that is like the definition of humiliation if you're the speaker and you're trying to run the House. That may not have been the most important issue, but it was probably a factor. The other is we forget, because we see the Republican Party through the eyes of, for very good reason, the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the rest of them. There is a big constituency, both in the House and out there in the country, that is in favor of Ukraine aid. And you saw it in the vote today. They got 150 Republican votes on the rule. Now, the rule isn't the bill specifically, but it's kind of a precursor. So it's not like he didn't have pressure. And there was certainly pressure coming from Mitch McConnell and from the Republicans in the Senate. I would just say one thing, and it's because I'm working on a piece on it for Monday. This delay was not without serious consequences. What happened to Ukraine in all those months when these people were dithering around? How many apartment buildings went down? How many people were killed? How hard it was for them to recruit people to the front lines because they were beginning to lose people? So the idea that we should all applaud and what a great job Johnson does, count me as a little bit skeptical, because people died because of this. A lot of people died and a lot of citizens died. And one thing in particular that several of the experts that I talked to pointed out is their electricity, their power grid has essentially been destroyed. And that probably wouldn't have happened, or wouldn't have happened to the extent it did, had they had the proper support from the United States.
I mean, it's war. Time and dithering matter. It's now time to take a moment for our sidebar feature, which explains some of the issues and topics that are prominent in the news. Today's feature is about education rights in the prison system and the federal government's role in expanding access to education for incarcerated individuals. To explain this topic, we welcome Catherine Barnett. Catherine Barnett is the author of Into Perfect Spheres, Such Holes Are Pierced, The Game of Boxes, and Human Hours. Her poetry has been published in former U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser's column, American Life in Poetry. She is a recipient of the Whiting Award and a Guggenheim Fellowship. I give you Catherine Barnett on education rights in the prison system.
For many decades, access to education for those in prison has been recognized as an important element of rehabilitation. Studies have shown that access to educational opportunities in prison correlates with reduced recidivism. There is a somewhat checkered history in the United States of growth of education programs in prison. These began in the 19th century, often led by religious organizations. By the 1930s, most prisons had some sort of educational system available to inmates. By 1983, most prisons offered college-level instruction. Throughout the 60s and 70s, the federal government created programs to expand access to education for students. A major initiative was the Basic Educational Opportunity Grant, later renamed the Pell Grant. Initially, prisoners were eligible for Pell Grants. In 1994, however, The Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act barred current federal or state inmates from applying for Pell Grants. As a result, many prisons stopped offering post-secondary education. In recent years, backlash against the 1994 ban has grown. In 2015, President Obama launched the Second Chance Pell Pilot Program, which allowed a small number of inmates to take college classes. Since then, more and more colleges and officials have expressed support for similar programs. Finally, as part of the massive Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021, Congress reinstated the ability of prisoners to apply for Pell Grants. For Talking Feds, I'm Catherine Barnett.
Thank you, Catherine Barnett. Catherine's work is available for purchase at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and other major booksellers.
All right, it is now time for a spirited debate brought to you by our sponsor, Total Wine and More. Each episode, you'll be hearing an expert talk about the pros and cons of a particular issue in the world of wine, spirit, and beverages.
Thank you, Harry. Today's spirited debate comes with a bit of a twist as we look to the very top of the wine bottle and ask which is better, cork or screw top? At face value, people think screw top equals cheap wine, which, as it turns out, isn't exactly true. The reason for screw tops is to ensure the wine tastes as the winemaker intended. Cork, which has been used to seal wine bottles for over 100 years, is a proven way to age wine effectively by allowing minute amounts of air to come in contact with the wine. This slowly develops a softer texture and enhances flavor. Now cork, traditional as it is, has a downside called TCA, which causes something called cork taint. Now cork taint, while affecting a very small percentage of wines, can be a big disappointment, causing a musty aroma similar to the smell of wet cardboard and contaminating a great bottle of wine. We turn back again to screw caps, which are cork taint proof, of course, not to mention much easier to open, especially in a kitchen surrounded by witnesses. How the aging process affects wines with a screw cap is yet to be known as wineries continue to test. Whether it's a cork or screw top, at Total Wine & More, our guides will help you find the perfect wine to match your tastes. After all, it's not just about what's on top of the bottle, it's what's inside that counts.
Thanks to our friends at Total Wine & More for today's A Spirited Debate.
All right, let's just take 1 minute, about as much as the Senate gave to the Mayorkas impeachment, where they just gave it back of the hand. Did the House accomplish anything at all, including in their political goal of trying to make the Democrats look weak on immigration, or just a total empty gesture?
I don't think that they really accomplished much here. I don't think this is something that truly penetrated the consciousness of the American people. You know, maybe on the margins, they can argue that Democrats weren't interested in holding a trial for this guy who was responsible for the chaotic border or something like that. But this was an exercise that was undermined by their own Republican members. You know, you had Lisa Murkowski, the Republican from Alaska, voting present on whether this first article of impeachment was even constitutional, was even a high crime and misdemeanor. You had a bunch of comments from senators who basically called this a waste of time. The first vote was tied. It didn't even pass the House the first time. Like, the idea that this was such a pressing issue wasn't even verified by the Republicans who were doing this, because so many of them were just so nonplussed by this whole exercise. And so I think it's very difficult to make the American people care about that.
And to Peter's point, it's hard to argue that the other side is weak on the border when you voted down this really tough border security bill. And then they played this game in the House. Oh, we really want it back in. No, we don't want it back in. So it's kind of been a mess. And I think for Republicans, this was one of their best issues. So if this is kind of neutralized to any degree, that's probably not a good thing for them.
I think to Harry, your point about the consequences on the ground in Ukraine, I think the consequences on the ground in the impeachment world, right, in the future use of impeachment as a constitutional tool for accountability. I mean, I think that you can make the argument that in a different way, both the House and the Senate have created precedents now that will make it harder to use impeachment as a legitimate tool for scrutiny of corrupt and unfit officials, because the House Republicans didn't get a single Democratic vote, didn't even really try. There wasn't even a consideration, frankly, of any kind of bipartisanship there. And it was all about a policy dispute. That's certainly the lesson that people came away. It was all about a policy dispute, basically a vote of no confidence, rather than a justiciable crime, high crime misdemeanor on which to hold a trial. By the same token, I think the Senate Democrats, by simply dismissing it with the back of their hand, the Republicans made the argument, and they're not wrong, that there is now a precedent set so that when Trump wins, if he were to win, and the House were to impeach him for the third time, because why not? Senate Republicans, if they were to be in charge, say, we don't think there's a crime there. We're not even going to bother to have a trial. And that is a complete change in our structure. So while this may not be all that important and we'll all have forgotten about it by tomorrow, there are lasting consequences in the way impeachment now is or is not a useful constitutional tool.
I think if you can't impeach someone for leading an insurrection, impeachment as a tool in general is probably not viable in our political system where it's so divided. I think you're never going to get anyone impeached.
Or convicted, yeah. Okay, 1 minute left for our final feature, five words or fewer, where we take a question and that each of us has to answer in five words or fewer. It was pretty noteworthy that Trump kept nodding off in court. The question is, what was he dreaming about? Five words or fewer.
Supreme Court grants presidential immunity.
Okay, perfect five.
Find a juror to hang.
His next Trump golf championship.
And I a little bit along the same lines, never having descended the escalator. All right, we are out of time. Thank you so much to Jen, Aaron, and Peter. And thank you very much, listeners, for tuning in to Talking Feds. If you like what you've heard, please tell a friend to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever they get their podcasts, and please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube, where we are posting full episodes, talking books, and bonus video content. You can follow us on Twitter at TalkingFedsPod, and you can look to see our latest offerings on Patreon. Talking Feds is still a completely independent production, so if you like the work we do and are inclined to support the show, joining our Patreon is the best way to do it. You can now leave voicemails with your questions for me and our guests, whether for Talking Five or general questions about the inner workings of the legal system for our sidebar segments. All you have to do is call 727-279-5339 and leave a voice message. And you can still also email us your questions at questions@talkingfeds.com. Thanks for tuning in, and don't worry. As long as you need answers, the feds will keep talking. Talking Feds is produced by Catherine Devine, associate producer Meredith McCabe, sound engineering by Matt McCardle. Our research producer is Zeke Reed. Rosie Dawn Griffin and David Lieberman are our contributing writers, and production assistants by Akshaj Turbailu. Thanks very much to Catherine Barnett for explaining education rights in the federal prison system. Our music is, as ever, by the amazing Philip Glass. This week's episode is dedicated to Leah Carey and her parents, Shira and Jason. Talking Feds is a production of Delito LLC. I'm Harry Littman. Talk to you later.